From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For months, Americans have heard two presidential candidates frame the country's challenges in very different ways. President Bush warns of threats from every corner. John Kerry says Bush has made us more vulnerable to attack. On Tuesday, we took a close-up look at George Bush and his faith. Tonight, we turn to Kerry and his leadership. In a dangerous time, this hour, On Point, candidate John Kerry, the war on terror, and the issue of leadership in the final days of the campaign. But first, in the Middle East, an ailing Yasser Arafat will be headed to France tomorrow. The 75-year-old Palestinian leader will fly to Paris for treatment of an undisclosed medical condition. Wire stories are sharing reports of everything from gallstones to leukemia. John Ward Anderson is a correspondent for The Washington Post and has been keeping a close watch on developments at Arafat's West Bank compound in Ramallah. I asked him about the latest news on the Palestinian leader's health.
It's been announced that he's going to be leaving for Paris, France, tomorrow morning on a flight in order to get some kind of medical treatment. The exact nature of his ailment is a little bit of a mystery here. It's sort of all over the map. Some people say he's got some kind of stomach or colon cancer, and that's been denied by the Palestinian authorities. Other people are saying it may be leukemia, but nobody really knows. I talked to the Nabil Shah, the foreign minister of the Palestinian Authority, and he said the real problem was that they needed to get him out of his battered compound out in Ramallah and get him to a first-world hospital where he can undergo a barrage of tests and they can figure out what's ailing him.
Whatever the cause of his ailment, what is known about the symptoms that he's showing? How bad off is he?
Well, again, there's a lot of dispute about that. You know, the Palestinian Authority is quite closed lips about it. They've released a picture, and he looks, I can tell you, he looks very frail. He looks very pale. He's slumped down in a chair. He's extremely weak, according to the foreign minister. There have been reports that he fell unconscious during dinner Wednesday night. That's been denied. There are other reports that he doesn't recognize people. That's also been denied. And so, like I say, it's a bit of a mystery exactly what he's got.
Yasser Arafat, as I understand, has not left his compound in Ramallah since 2001. What strictures has he been under there?
He's very much besieged, although it's not now surrounded by tanks, Israeli tanks, like it used to be. His great fear is that if he just steps foot outside of the compound, that Israeli military is going to swoop in, grab him, and exile him to another country. And so, yes, he hasn't left the compound in years. The only reason he's going to Paris, according to the foreign minister, is that Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, the Israeli prime minister, has personally guaranteed that when his treatment is finished, he'll actually be allowed to return back to Ramallah.
And if Yasser Arafat's health problems are serious, if he should not survive, what's in the works?
Well, the succession is very, very confused because in Yasser Arafat himself, he is the leader of most of the major Palestinian institutions, the Palestinian Authority, which governs the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which is the umbrella group that includes all the Palestinians who are in exile, the Fatah political movement, which is the most powerful political organization. He heads all three. And the real question is whether or not one individual is going to be able to unite those three posts the way Arafat has, and nobody believes that they will. So there, you could see a rather tough power struggle between some of the major players in the Palestinian Authority and the PLO to find out exactly who is going to take over each one of these institutions.
John, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz is quoting Israeli defense officials saying that they fear chaos if Arafat should die, that Palestinians might blame his death on them, that attacks on Israelis might increase. I know you and your crew at the Washington Post have spent time in the West Bank. What are Palestinians saying about the juncture they may be approaching here?
I haven't heard anybody say that they're going to blame the Israelis or attack Israelis any more than they already attacked the Israelis. I think what there really is just a lot of concern that this man who is a revolutionary icon and the symbol of Palestinian national aspirations may pass away. I mean, this is the guy who has kept the Palestinian cause in front of the world for decades now, and I think there's probably a legitimate concern on behalf of most Palestinians that without him, perhaps their mission is going to fall down even further than it already is on the world's agenda.
Worried that they might be forgotten.
Exactly. You can see that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is slipping off the front page of a lot of the newspapers and is not leading the news anymore because there's another big confrontation going on in this neighborhood over in Iraq. And it is Yasser Arafat that over the years is the person who has kept this at the top of the world's agenda.
On the other hand, both Israeli officials and officials in Washington have called Yasser Arafat an obstacle to peace and been very explicit about wishing for a different partner in the Palestinian leadership. Could his moving on, however that happens, might happen, open a way to peace?
That's a possibility. It could open the way to a lot of things. I mean, Arafat has been very authoritarian, and when he moves on, when he passes away, when he becomes incapacitated, I think there's a real possibility that you may see a new leadership rise up that is going to be more democratic and more transparent in the Palestinian Authority on the one hand. And on the other hand, you may also find people who are more willing, people that the United States and Israel are more willing to sit down and talk to. The real question is, if they don't have the stature and they don't have the credibility of Yasser Arafat, whether or not these people are going to take any kind of peace agreement or deal that they cut with the Israelis and sell it to the Palestinians the way Yasser Arafat could have.
Well, the world has long since learned not to write Yasser Arafat off, even in these circumstances we do not, but we'll be watching. John Ward Anderson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
John Ward Anderson is a correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with me from Jerusalem. Senator John Kerry doesn't use the black and white language that President Bush uses. He doesn't tend to talk in terms of good versus evil or say, you're with us or against us. Whether that's an advantage or not has been an open question in this campaign. Bush is a down-home Texan fighting a war on terror. Kerry, the Boston Brahmin, wants to build alliances to diminish terrorism to the point that it's a nuisance. In today's political discourse, that's a mouthful. New York Times Magazine writer Matt Bye had the opportunity to sit down with candidate Kerry for a profile. Bye describes a man that, yes, isn't good at sound bites. Kerry is careful, he's guarded, and this campaign has made him more so. But voters must decide, can he lead the fight against terrorism? Tonight on Point, John Kerry's reading of the War on Terror and the issue of leadership in the presidential campaign. You can join the conversation. Do you know where John Kerry stands on the war part of the war on terror? When John Kerry says he wants to reduce terrorism to a nuisance like organized crime or prostitution, does he sound wise to you or naive? And whose worldview makes you feel safer, bellicose Bush or careful Kerry? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Matt Bye, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He's been covering the election for the magazine. His most recent article is titled, Kerry's Undeclared War. Matt Bye, thanks for being with us tonight.
Sure. How are you, Tom?
We're great. Wonderful to have you back, Matt.
I know you're great because your Red Sox won. I want to congratulate you.
Yeah, we're over the moon, even if it's an eclipsing moon. We'll take it. Matt, also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Matt.
So we've got the Red Sox issue settled at least for now, and settled in a grand way as far as Boston goes, and thanks St. Louis for all that good hospitality out there. Matt, by your article came out a couple of weeks ago, big picture of John Kerry on the cover, and a lot of language inside that immediately became grist on the campaign trail. I think your quotes have been in the mouths of the president, the vice president, lots of Republicans since this piece came out. Why do you think what you wrote became so instantly part of the campaign exchange?
Well, I can tell you that I didn't expect it. I'm never very good at gauging what kind of quote is going to be useful for whose purpose, and I think that's a gift, not a liability. But I think, first of all, that obviously John Kerry's explaining that he felt terrorism could be put in a category like organized crime of being a nuisance to society rather than sort of an existential threat, as the president portrays it, really played into a major theme of the president's campaign, as they see it, which is that they alone understand the nature of the threat. They alone understand the historic arc of the threat, that it is related to the great battles of the 20th century, and that John Kerry would minimize it and therefore would not keep us safe. Below the surface of that of the campaign theme, my guess would be, and this is pure speculation on my part, that there's a whole lot of polling out there, perhaps both sides are looking at, that suggests that trying to tell the American public that the war on terror is not, in fact, a global war in the sense that they think it is a losing proposition during a presidential election.
That has sunk in, and a lot of people just look at the world that way. Matt, we asked you on because in these last days of the campaign, a lot of people, of course, have to come down to a decision about the person, the man. On Tuesday night, we talked with Ron Suskind, who, of course, profiled George Bush and looked in depth at his faith and the advantages and disadvantages, depending on the voter's view, that may flow out of that. It seems that you put your finger on what, for many voters, is a core issue, if they haven't already decided, about John Kerry, and it comes down to his understanding of national security or, in our current circumstances, you know, of how to fight terrorism, and wrapped right around that, the issue of leadership and whether he can rally the nation to his view on that. You entitled your big piece, Kerry's Undeclared War. What do you mean by undeclared war?
Well, you hit it right there, Tom. You really got what we're trying to get at, which is there are two elements to this. One is, you know, where is John Kerry on the world? What does he believe? Where does he think America should go in the next not just 2 years, but 20 years, 50 years to combat this threat of terrorism? But the other point, and that's implicit in that title, the undeclared war, is why don't we know? At this late stage of a campaign, why are people so muddy as to what it is that John Kerry actually believes? And what the case made in the piece, I hope convincingly, but it certainly didn't convince a lot of partisans, that essentially Senator Kerry is really cautious and afraid, in a sense, to make the case that he actually believes, to actually air his convictions, because of the kind of dialogue that goes on in a presidential campaign, because they feel the president is weak all by himself and they don't need to give him any extra ammunition, because they're concerned that they won't be able to make it understood and that it will be taken out of context, that essentially Senator Kerry has not stood up and made the case. And as you point out, this is an issue to some extent of just being able to articulate yourself, but also of leadership. And it is a question, should you, in a presidential campaign this close, are you bound to articulate a vision, and is it politically wise not to?
So Matt, let me ask you then. You've winkled a lot out here, but at the end of the day, have you figured it out? Can you tell us what candidate Kerry's undeclared war is, what he really believes is going on with terrorism and how it ought to be addressed?
You know, I think I can. I mean, there are people who would probably take issue, I should say, in all fairness, because this is sort of a deductive exercise. But yes, I mean, I think Senator Kerry sees Islamic radicalism and terrorism as part of a larger trend to which he has been very much attuned over the last 10 or 15 years of non-state actors, as they call them in the foreign policy community, people who are not governments, who do not occupy countries, becoming more consequential on the international scene. And because of the explosion of technology and the internet and weapons on the mass market, that a lot of groups that are not governments or state actors can now can and will be the next kind of major adversary for the United States. And dealing with these kinds of adversaries, Senator Kerry believes, is not simply a matter of using military force, although he's willing to do that. But it requires a lot of the same tactics that are used against organized crime and drug dealers. It requires countries to be able to get together and share intelligence and patrol borders and help each other in joint operations, because no one country is going to be able to stamp out a group of people who are intent on destroying others and who can bleed easily through borders and stay hidden throughout the world.
Jack Beatty, is that too much for American voters to take on board, or has John Kerry simply not been effective or willing to deliver that vision?
Somewhere between those two, willing or effective, you know, I mean, if you suspend Iraq from the equation, that's a very sound reading, it seems to me, of the threat. I mean, the army wasn't going to stop the men from getting into those planes. It was useless. We needed intelligence. We needed cooperation. We needed better monitoring of our internal security.
But on the eve of a presidential election, we also need a pretty clear public reading of how John Kerry sees the war on terror. And we're looking at the issue of leadership around that issue tonight. Matt Bye is with us from the New York Times. You can join this conversation as well. Do you know where John Kerry stands on the war part of the war on terror? And who sounds more optimistic, more hopeful? The president, who sees decades of war, or John Kerry, who wants to diminish terrorism to the point where it becomes a law enforcement issue? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about John Kerry's reading of the war on terror and the issue of leadership in the presidential campaign. You can join this conversation tonight. When John Kerry says he wants to reduce terrorism to a nuisance, does he sound wise to you or naive? And is John Kerry clear enough? Is he inspiring enough to lead in such a dangerous time? We're at 1-800-423-8255 tonight. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Got a couple of clips here that go straight at this. Matt Bye is with us from the New York Times. He's written up a big profile in the Times Magazine that went straight at the issue of John Kerry's view of the war and how it relates to his leadership capacity. The Republicans jumped all over it. Here's President Bush speaking at a rally in Greeley, Colorado on Monday, accusing John Kerry of having a pre-September 11th mindset when it comes to fighting terrorism.
Senator Kerry says that September the 11th did not change him much at all. And his policies make that clear. He says the war on terror is primarily a law enforcement and intelligence gathering operation. His top foreign policy advisor says the war is just a metaphor, like the war on poverty. The senator's goal is to go back to the mindset of the 1990s, when terrorism was seen as a nuisance, and we fought with subpoenas and a few cruise missiles.
There's the Bush interpretation. Now, in Philadelphia on Monday, John Kerry countered by saying that mistakes and miscalculations made by President Bush in the war on terror and in Iraq have made America less safe.
They have miscalculated again and again and again with the security of our nation. Miscalculated how they chose to go to war, miscalculated about how many troops they needed, miscalculated about Osama bin Laden at Tora Bora. And the result is, if George Bush can't recognize his mistakes as he goes along, how's he going to fix them? We don't want four more years of the same. We need a new policy, a fresh start, new credibility in order to get the job done in Iraq and get our troops home. That's what we need to do.
John Kerry in Philadelphia on Monday night responding to the president's criticism, and lines the president using there taken almost directly from Matt Bye's piece in the New York Times. Matt, I wish we could just run down these. I mean, in fact, there was a lot of talk about whether or not the president misinterpreted John Kerry, but the lines he lifted right there are pretty much direct from you, which we take as coming from Kerry or the Kerry camp. And let's just start with the first one. John Kerry saying, sitting with you in an interview, that 9/11 did not change him. What did he mean by that? What does it say about his view of the world?
I think what he meant by that is that he was one of the first senators, in his view, and I think it's fairly supported, to understand the threat of non-state actors, to understand the threat of terrorism, be it Islamic terrorism or another form, and that he felt that he had a sense of how to combat that well before September 11th, and that the events of that day in September 2001 did not change his fundamental view of how to combat that threat. Of course, it was an easily lifted quote because it sounds a little bit tone deaf. What I asked him was, personally or politically, did this in any way change you? And he chose for whatever reason not to, you know, voice any kind of personal transformation as a result of that event. And in politics, I think people expect a certain amount of that.
So he wanted to say to you, no, it didn't change me because I was already ahead of the ball here, ahead of the game.
I think that is his essential point, yes.
But of course, President Bush says, look, so much changed on that day it wasn't possible, and this suggests a kind of back-to-the-90s mindset. President Bush says, criticizes John Kerry for wanting to approach terrorism as a law enforcement and intelligence issue. I want to expand that just a little. A, is that the way he describes it? And paired with that, does John Kerry see the United States as being in a war on terror, the president's phrase that he always uses, that everyone essentially uses now?
Yeah, and that's an issue I really tried to get at in the story, because I think it's very important. It's not simply a semantic issue. Is this a war? Is it not a war? And I think in my final analysis, and if Senator Kerry were here, to be fair, he would probably say I was wrong. But in my final analysis, he does not believe in his heart of hearts that it's an actual war. And what I mean by that is that, look, both of these men, both sides of the aisle, both parties believe in essentially the same array of tactics that are required to combat terrorism. The difference is in emphasis. It really is. And it's not a small difference. The president believes and his supporters believe that this is first and foremost a military operation with support that takes the form of law enforcement and interdiction and things like that. Senator Kerry and the folks who support him and advise him believe that this is first and foremost an effort of international cooperation, an effort of law enforcement, and of confronting a new kind of threat that doesn't lend itself to old measures, and that it has a military component. This is a critical difference, and I think, you know, just take a step back from it for a second, I think what we were trying to do with this piece in particular was to make this difference clearer for people who are trying to make an informed decision. And I think, you know, I think just from the conversation we're having and what they're saying on the stump, yes, some of the stuff has been taken out of context, but I think that conversation is going on, and I'm glad for it.
And it means there's a real difference here. Now, when Senator Kerry says he'd like to see the threat of terrorism reduced to a nuisance, again, President Bush jumped all over that, and I think a lot of people were left scratching their heads, wondering, is this guy naive? I mean, we saw towers come down. That doesn't look like a nuisance.
Well, a lot of other people were scratching their heads saying, wait a minute, he wants to reduce terrorism to it's a nuisance. What's wrong with that? I could live with that. Yeah, I mean, look, this quote was taken. I mean, we've talked about the context of it now some, and the Bush folks took that quote literally out of context. That is to say, not inaccurately in any way. They said he says it can be reduced to a level of nuisance, but without any of the context that you and I have just talked about, so that it certainly lost some of its meaning. I regret to say that it was a lot of my colleagues in the media and your colleagues in the media who actually made the jump from out of context to inaccurate by then shorthanding the quote as Kerry, you know, has gone around comparing terrorism to a nuisance or comparing it to prostitution and gambling, which of course is not at all what he did.
Though he did cite prostitution and gambling in your piece.
He did, but he didn't say terrorism just like prostitution and gambling. What he said was, I think we, you know, in the same way that we don't run around worrying about prostitution and gambling, although we know it exists, we should get to a point in this country where we don't worry every day when we go out of our homes about terrorism. And that, in a sense, is diametrically opposed to what the president is really saying to the public, which is this is the defining threat of our time. We are afraid, and we should be afraid, and we have to be vigilant every day, and it's not going away. Now, some will see that as a more courageous stand, a more honest stand, to say to people, look, you know, we're going to have more attacks. This is going to go on. But I think, you know, Senator Kerry sees his view as much more optimistic, saying we don't have to have that situation in this country if you address it properly.
We can get on top of this thing. Jack Beatty met by saying that there were our phrases and words and notions scraped out of their context here. And made to look almost ridiculous at certain points. But he's saying behind that, what he found, despite the negative way in which a lot of his piece was interpreted, certainly by the Bush campaign, he's saying he found a candidate who's been thoughtful about the terrorism challenge. A, what do you think about the way John Kerry's thinking about the terrorism threat, Jack? And B, and I think this is important as people decide on a leader, what about his communication skills, his leadership, his rallying skills in getting his view of this conflict across?
Well, as I said earlier, I think he's just absolutely right about, you know, defining the nature of the threat. It is the Bush administration that tied terrorism to states and leave out Afghanistan. That's a special case. And that logic took him into Iraq. Kerry is saying, no, this is transnational. That's the whole problem with it. There isn't an address. So how do you deal with it? You can't send the Air Force. You can't send the Army. What do you send? You get better intelligence. You get better espionage. You get, in other words, again, if you just think of September 11th, what good would the Army have been? I mean, that's about intelligence. So I think he's right on there. But where he goes wrong, it seems to me, is that he doesn't give any, or at least in my hearing, much ideological content to this particular state actor. I haven't heard him talk much about the Islamist element, what that is. I haven't heard him talk much about the Saudi connection with this. After all, where the terrorists were from, where their funding was from, where the funding for the insurgents and terrorists in Iraq, some of it is from. He hasn't stepped up to that. And he hasn't stepped up to, well, why are the terrorists, why were we attacked? Not saying it any way justified, but what, you know, is it because they hate our freedom, as Bush says, or is it because of the things we do in our foreign policy? Ergo, tilt toward Israel in the Middle East, or not really deal with trying to bring out a solution, or, although you can't hold that against Clinton. And putting bases in Saudi Arabia, so he's not thought it through, so that he could have a counter theory to Bush and say, you know, here's the background of this, you've just got it wrong. So that communication, I don't think has been candid there.
So, or even if he has thought it through, as in Met by's headline, he may not have declared it. We're looking tonight at what John Kerry sees in the national security challenge and what the way he's declared or not declared what he sees says about this man's leadership capabilities. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Let's turn to our callers. Paul is calling from New Berlin, Wisconsin. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I think it's fairly obvious what Senator Kerry's approach is, and that's been to try to apply a surgical procedure-type approach to understand the nature of the problem, what's motivating the terrorists. And there's going to be many motivations for many different, you know, for wherever the terror appears. People have ideological reasons, obviously. He wants to understand those reasons by having good intelligence between the nations so he understands specific issues. They can network together on a worldwide level. That's why the idea of passing the global test is everybody's intelligence. Do we jive on this information? And then go in and take out the people in surgically, specifically, and bring down the level of fear.
And you sound supportive of this, Paul. Do you think John Kerry has been fully effective in communicating it? If he were elected next Tuesday, if he would become president, has he demonstrated the capacity to rally the country behind this vision?
The one thing I think he has not brought forth yet is that a lot of it is psychological war, and I think that's what he was implying when he said bring it down to the level of nuisance. The fear is what is paralyzing. We got attacked, 2 years ago? How long ago was it?
By a bunch
of people, well orchestrated, and they did a symbolic attack. They made their statement. But the fear that has been generated since then, you know, which has obviously been a control factor for a government, you know, for government, it's like politics 101. If you want to control the people, make them fearful. So
Paul, we've got it, and I thank you for your call. Matt Bai, how about it? Paul is saying, hey, it's obvious what he thinks. I get it. It's not that tricky. But yet, you talk to voters and you've talked with insiders in Kerry's own party saying that his strategy for defeating the terrorists, quoting you here, remains so ethereal. So which is it? Is he playing on what he wants to do or not, and why?
Well, and if you look at the polling, too, I think, you know, it's not just my anecdotal information. It's very clear that people don't have a clear sense of this. And I'd go back in answering that question to what Jack was just saying. I think he hit on an excellent point, which is there's two issues here. And you've talked about it, too, when you talk about leadership. There's the issue of knowing how to confront the problem. And there's the issue of giving people a larger narrative, for lack of a better word, or a larger explanation that they can put into the context of their lives. And that is a critical piece of leadership. People are going to be asked to sacrifice for this. Probably more Americans are going to die for this, not just soldiers, but civilians. We are going to have this threat and the consequences of it for a period of time. And I think Americans need to know more than, well, this can be made to be like corruption or gambling. That there has to be a sense of why I think we're in this and why it is people are being asked to sacrifice and why it is we're being targeted. These are questions that get answered in campaigns. This is how we hash out our national philosophy and our national narrative. And President Bush, to his credit, has given an overarching sense of why he believes this is happening and where he believes it's going to lead us. And no matter how much sense on some level Senator Kerry's approach to this may be, that is something he has really not provided to this point.
You described a number of small indicators of John Kerry's guardedness in this campaign season, about even letting you know what kind of water he drinks, or, you know, very little things, because he's seen how it can be blown up, it can be misinterpreted. But ultimately, on this, a president has to communicate. They have to lead. Is he meeting that test? Not a global test, but just that test.
The water. I've heard from more liberals about the water bottles than I can tell you. But I agree with you. That is a question. Is he meeting that test? And it may be that in this kind of polarized environment, with so many voters know exactly how they feel, he doesn't have to articulate a grander philosophy. But you know, I do think that from the beginning of this campaign, the sense on John Kerry's side of this election has been that this president is weak, that he's afflicted by twin problems that are really lethal for a sitting president, a flagging economy and a war that's gone wrong, that his approval ratings are low, that John Kerry is the anointed alternative, and that it's enough for him, in a sense, to be not Bush and to not do anything mortally stupid, and that if he can meet the and if he meets those two requirements, that's going to be enough. Now the question I think
but here
asking,
we are. The vote is on Tuesday, and in plenty of polls, George Bush is still leading.
That's right. I mean, and it's pretty incredible when you look at his numbers in a historic sense, and when you look at where he's at in this country, that he is, at least in a dead heat. And the question you ask, which is I think a very, very relevant question, is what happens after the election? And let's suppose that it is enough, and let's suppose that Senator Kerry does become president and stands up before Congress and stands up before the United Nations. Do we know where he's going to lead people, and does he have the support of people to go there? I mean, a lot of people will point out when you raise this issue, well, President Bush didn't have a mandate, and he came out with quite a radical agenda, and it didn't stop him. But, you know, I think September 11th was a really transformative event in this country, and it gave a president a lot of room to run. And I don't think Senator Kerry would have that same latitude.
If John Kerry's elected president, is the White House going to stop talking about the war on terror? Is that going to become antiquated language? You quote Richard Holbrooke, the Clinton-era diplomat, of course, a potential Secretary of State in a Kerry administration, saying, as President Bush quoted, the war on terror is like saying the war on poverty. It's just a metaphor. Would we see that language, that idea, go away, Matt Bai?
No, I don't think so. And a lot of liberal policymakers don't think it's a war. But the political reality that they understand is that Democrats have a weakness on national security. They don't enjoy the same credibility with the electorate that Republicans do on this issue. And so they take extra care to sound tough and sturdy. And, you know, Senator Kerry says basically without prompting everywhere he goes as much as possible, I'm going to hunt him down and kill him. I'm going to hunt him down and kill him. He really wants people to understand how willing he is to be tough. And I think Democrats think, and perhaps rightfully so, that if they were to begin to try and redefine that process from a war to something else, they would look as weak as they have been portrayed by their adversaries, and it would be detrimental to their ability to get things done.
And Jack Beatty, a lot of what John Kerry talks about is effectiveness, kind of the I don't mean to diminish it, but the sort of technocrat, how well we carry out this effort against terrorism.
That's very true. I mean, he hasn't articulated a counter vision. He's given indications. I mean, when he says that he wants to buy up the nuclear material in the former Soviet Union at a third the time of the president, that's a strategic idea. You want to keep that material from ever getting into the hands of terrorists. When he talks about, beefing up homeland defense, that's certainly part of the strategy. But he doesn't put it together in a whole, sort of theory of the case. Bush has the theory of the case, and Kerry's saying, I'll apply it, but I'll do it more intelligently.
Do it my way. We are talking tonight about John Kerry's reading of the war on terror and the issue of leadership in the presidential campaign. You can join us tonight. Who sounds more optimistic here, more hopeful, the president who sees decades of war or John Kerry who wants to diminish terrorism to the point where it becomes a law enforcement issue? And if John Kerry's plan for terrorism is so great, why is the handling of the war on terror still George Bush's strongest suit in the polls? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about John Kerry's reading of the war on terror and the issue of leadership in the presidential campaign in the last few days before the vote. Our guest tonight, Matt Bai, contributing writer for the covering the election for the New York Times Magazine. You can join this conversation as well. Is John Kerry clear enough? Is he inspiring enough to lead in a dangerous time? Is America ready for a different style of leadership, a Kerry style, or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom. I'd like to use your last remarks to frame my comments, wondering which candidate was the most optimistic in the war on terror. And I think without a doubt that the president's vision for the spread of democracy, particularly in the Middle East, contrasts with John Kerry's realpolitik vision that's kind of most appropriate for a Kissinger or a Brent Scowcroft from Bush 41's administration. And you framed the discussion with the war on terror, but in particular the project extending democracy in the Middle East. I think you can make reasonable critiques of it, but I think it's a worthy project of the American people. And
that's the Bush project. So are you saying you're going with the Bush bigger, the Bush vision here, the kind of grand vision of transformation?
Without a doubt. I mean, I think you can make a conservative critique of that project. That but I think that the Democratic Party and John Kerry in particular have failed to do so, rather than saying advancing conservative arguments that it is exceedingly difficult and impractical.
John, let us pick that up, and thanks for your call. Matt Bai, let me boil that down, if I may, to the issue of scale. Americans saw those attacks on September 11th. They saw those enormous towers with a lot of people inside come down, and the scale of the affront to the national security, to the national psyche, was very large. George Bush, very swiftly, with a lot of neocon, preparation in a funny way, even though no one knew it was coming, responded at scale. Is John Kerry responding in his national security perspective at a scale that can satisfy the country's need for a big response to a big perceived wound?
Well, no, I don't think he is. But what some would argue who support Senator Kerry, to be fair, they would say that, this isn't maybe we've inflated the scale, and that's not a healthy thing. Now, yes, this was a terrible traumatic event, but that, in fact, there has not been another event, that this is not as huge an enemy as we think it is. This is not 1938. We're not talking about Hitler. We're not talking about the Iron Curtain and the Russians. We're talking about a band of criminals who pulled off an operation, and albeit an extremely sophisticated one, but who do not represent a kind of constant and as I say, existential threat, which is a word that Joe Biden used when I talked to him, Senator Biden, that it does not constitute the existential threat that, the great enemies of the 20th century would, and we should not try to inflate it into that, and that's what the president has done. Now, just to go – I don't want to dodge the question, so just to go back to what you asked me, has he met it with the scale that's required for people at this moment? I don't think so. I mean, that's kind of where I come down in the piece, that there's something less lofty about it. There's something – as Jack says, it is a question of effectiveness, but it's not a question of vision. And I think that, whether or not it's enough to get him elected, we don't know. He looks, he's certainly in a dead heat right now. But how you govern without having put forward a vision like that for a problem that does not materialize overnight, but that goes back to the campaign and before, that's a larger question he would have to confront.
Dick is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Dick. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, I've been listening to John Kerry for quite some time, and I believe he has elaborated on most of the points that people are raising, that saying that he needs to report. But I think the reporting is often heavily skewed by, in fact, a Bush-generated view that he hasn't been specific enough. And I think the media does tend to echo those comments over and over, as opposed to truly responding to and reporting what Kerry says. And even tonight, when you did talk about some of the points that Kerry has made over time, they're very parallel to the comments that you say that he should be making all along. But yet we continue to hear through reporting of this lack of specificity, the lack of an approach. And I think it's often the reporting that is beginning to place in people's minds.
So you hear a kind of Bush message echo chamber or a media playing into that simplify dynamic here, Dick.
Yeah, I truly believe that. I just heard John Kerry today. There were 80,000 people listening to him today in Madison. And, I think I heard him say, and I think I've heard him say for months, the points that you're asking him to elucidate on.
Dick, we've got it. Matt Bai, how do you interpret that? The polls still show that support on this one issue, greater for President Bush than for John Kerry. Dick was there today in Madison with 80,000, as he counts them anyway, people, and he says he heard loud and clear what John Kerry wants to do.
Well, first of all, I think Senator Kerry hit some of these points. There's no question. There are others that he simply does not. And I know because I spent a good 2.5 hours talking to him about it. And I've seen his speeches and read through all the speeches and watched some. There are some of these points that he definitely hits. But again, it's this question of whether he puts it into a a cohesive vision that people can understand, and there are some core elements of it, like is this in fact a war, is it not, that he actually won't go anywhere near. And, you know, I just want to say, you know, in response to Dick, because I understand how he's feeling, I understand a lot of people are, and you know, I got to tell you, at this stage of the campaign, a few days out, it's exhausting for those of us who covered it to be caught in this crossfire of distrust about the media. And I actually wrote about it for this Sunday a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're in a moment where people really expect and want confirmational journalism, for lack of a better term. They really want to hear what they believe. And when you write a piece like this, which you know, sort of went in depth into an issue and not from any one vantage point, you know, you basically find that people take away from it the pieces and the parts of it that they want. They're not so much reading it to listen or to learn as they are to see, is it going to help my guy? Does it hurt my guy? How does it make my guy look? And, you know, I really think it's important. I know that he thinks we're skewed. I know that he thinks we've bought the line, and the other side thinks the same thing. And if I told you, you know, how disparate the criticisms are, you know, it wouldn't surprise you. But I think it's important for us to stand up at this time and continue to write balanced and thoughtful and in-depth journalism, and not to cave to the pressure to give people the version of events that they would like to hear on either side.
Well, and we decided to go out there and look for those soft spots. We talked we had a pretty tough discussion on George Bush on Tuesday night around faith and what Ron Suskind, who also wrote for the New York Times Magazine, calls his absence from the reality-based world of his opponents. I mean, if this is John Kerry's soft spot in the polls, we want to look at it tonight. If people are still thinking about it on their way to those polls, Jack, I hear you there.
Yeah, I just want to go back to our caller from North Carolina. I really think he put his finger on something. Kerry has not. I think he's a realist in foreign policy, just as the caller said. I think he's somebody who doesn't think, you know, that to transform the Middle East exceeds A, our capacities, because we can't invade these countries. We can try to influence them. And B, maybe even our necessities. After all, what we need from that part of the world is oil, and no matter who owns those countries, no matter what the governments, they have to sell their oil. And a sort of realist critique of this, you know, millennialist Bush notion of transformation. He hasn't done that, and I think he believes it, so that's a failing. And second, he hasn't challenged Bush's preemptive doctrine. And in ones available to him, that is the Cold War doctrine of deterrence, but in a new light. No, you can't deter a stateless terrorist, but the fact is that if a nuclear bomb, God forbid, goes off in an American city, North Korea and or Iran are going to pay dearly. Why can't Kerry try to institute deterrence by saying, look, we're sorry, but if a bomb goes off here, we're going to blame you, so you had better do everything you can to make sure that doesn't happen. Because the fact is that if that horrifying thing happens, it would be the end of North Korea.
Matt Bai, we've just got half a minute left. John Kerry said, yes, there's a war, but it's a very different kind of war. If John Kerry wins on Tuesday, are we going to have a president who comes to the country and says, it's more different than you think. It's different from what George Bush told you.
I don't. No, but I suspect not. I think, again, as I said before, I think that Democrats feel they have to be very careful in how they communicate on this issue.
Even if they win.
And I think Senator Kerry's main objective would be to go out to the world and to the national community and to project a different kind of America, a different kind of foreign policy, and a different kind of force, but not to set about with a whole new framework that could be misinterpreted.
So off we go to November 2nd. Matt Bai, thanks for all of your work, and thanks for being with us tonight. Matt Bai,
sure,
contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Jack Beatty, stand by. We're going to hear a few sounds this evening, on of all evenings, from the Red Sox historic World Series win. This is On Point. Last night in St. Louis, the Boston Red Sox made history and did something many of their fans feared they would never see in their lifetimes.
The 1-0 pitch, here it is. Swing and a ground ball, stabbed by Folk. He has it. He underhands to first, and the Boston Red Sox are the world champions for the first time in 86 years.
We've waited a long time for this, and it's about time it's here. Well deserved. Go Red Sox, 2004 World Series champions!
You gotta give me just a couple of minutes of feeling great. It's been 86 years.
This means the world to these fans, because so many fans have come to me and saying, this is the year. Is this going to be the year? You know, no more will they have to say, is this going to be the year? Or
or anything like that. You know, I want them to enjoy this just as much as we're enjoying it, and I know they are.
I'm sure there's a lot of people in New England that are dancing in the streets right now. For that, I'm thrilled.
The Boston Red Sox have forever put that 1918 chant to rest as this band of characters who showed great character all season have come through and won the world championship for New England.
Happy, happy, happy sounds there. Jack Beatty, you know, truth be told, I grew up in Cardinal territory. But you could not live in Boston and not get caught up in this 86-year drought and the longing and the belief. It was absolutely a magnetic story around this team. And now, under an eclipsing moon, that victory.
Yes, and you know, perhaps people missed this, and maybe I almost missed it in the publicity. But the Red Sox are going to put up their World Championship banner on opening day, and guess who they're playing? Yes, the New York Yankees.
Oh, boy. Oh boy. Feast on this, dear Yankees. Feast on,
so
feast your eyes on this.
Right there. But, you know, this business of the curse, I don't mean to be too serious, but some of this was self-administered. I mean, from most of the post-war era, the beginning of it at least, for racist reasons, the Red Sox did not draft African-American players or Hispanic players. And those were the stars of baseball, the Larry Dobies, the Don Newcombs, the Willie Mayses, the McCoveys. Other teams went to championships because they had these great players. The owner of the Boston Red Sox, Tom Yawkey, would have no part of it. And that was a self-administered curse. And it lives on today in Fenway Park, where you will see nary an African-American face.
But, boy, on that field, you've got every hue going
absolutely.
On.
And
what a team. It's true. I remember the 67 World Series with the Cardinals, and you saw a very different racial profile of the two teams. But, man, the longing is really there. And that year, 1918, that Red Sox fans have struggled with for all those years, now maybe consigned to the history books.
Yes, and if Democrats are looking for some symbolic resonance in the year, it doesn't do to look at it too carefully. There was a war on, and the president, and it was a month from being over.
You mean in 1918?
In 1918, and you had a president who wanted to transform the world. You know, he was the original George Bush, crusade for freedom and so on.
Woodrow
and
Wilson, then, Grand Pappy.
And then his party had a terrible misfortune. 8 Democratic senators died. That meant the Republicans took over. That meant that Henry Cabot Lodge became the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He said, "No, Mr. President, you want to join the League of Nations. You want to have a global test. You want to let those Europeans decide whether we go to war. No, it has to be decided by a vote of Congress." Well, that was the debate between them. The treaty went down. Wilson said it broke the heart of the world. And he said, because of this, we're going to have to do this all over again. And, of course, he was right about that.
With everything that came after, you're sort of drawing the line there from 1918 through that war on to the rise of one Adolf Hitler.
There you go.
So 1918, World War I, Adolf Hitler, World War II, not a lucky penny date. Let's hope 2004 is better.
Let's hope it's better, and I think Democrats hope that somehow the resonance of this is gonna rub off on Kerry. But he's got to get his scores straight. The other day he alluded to he had the wrong score of a game. But certainly every political journalist is going to use this now as a cliche, right? For the next couple of days at least.
Oh, yeah.
The force is with Boston.
It's there. But what a terrific night for the Boston Red Sox and for
absolutely.
Boston. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.